The committee, Subdivision Committee on Veterans of Services will come to order. Clerk will take the roll. And if I could have someone who's been present at the last meeting to approve the minutes. Minutes have been moved. Can I have a second? Minutes have been seconded. Are there any additions or corrections or any thoughts on what was written the last time that they want to, anyone want to challenge or talk about? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Well, thank you for coming to this, is it the second meeting now already that we're, boy, time's going fast. We're rolling right along. Today, members, we have before you your agenda, and we're asking the Department of Veterans Affairs to come forward to give us a brief background about their programs and services, and we have members in the audience that will be doing that, and then an overview from the Minnesota County Veterans Service Officer Program, and then any other things that are going to be come before us. So I'd like to have the Commissioner and former Adjutant General, Mr. Larry Shelato, come, Deputy Commissioner Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner Worlds, and looks like we're having a substitute for Mr. McElhaney, Sherry Krumschreiter, if I'm saying that right, hopefully in the wings to testify. So welcome to the committee, General. I should respect my elders or those two people in authority over me because I served under General Shelato, serving in the Air National Guard and also the Reserves. So welcome to our committee. We look forward to what you have to say to us. And with that, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. My name is Larry Shelato. I am the new Commissioner for the Veterans Affairs. And the previous 7 years, I was Commissioner of Military Affairs, the Adjutant General for the Minnesota National Guard. During those 7 years, we often said we were the number one producer of veterans in the state of Minnesota. And when I retired from that position as a mandatory term and age requirement, I stepped down, and about 2-3 months going by, I realized that there's still a whole realm of people, veterans, all across the state of Minnesota, totaling over 400,000, that need the services and the care that has been offered and promised by our government and the state. The Department of Veterans Affairs position came open. I did apply for it, and I fortunately had worked with Governor Dayton when he was senator and got to know him and the development of the Yellow Ribbon Program, which he got the initial funding federally that gave us that infusion of cash to allow us to survive. And now that is a $400-some million program on the national level. And but that's taking care of one group and what we are doing. So today in our presentation, I'm still new. I'm learning a lot, as you see with all our veterans in the audience. They represent a wide variety of resources, tools, techniques, processes, procedures, whether it be homeless vets or just caring for people, helping them get their benefits. It becomes absolutely critical. We have two major components to the Veterans Affairs, the programs and the general aid, and then the the veterans homes. I'm still learning the language and making sure I get it correct. So at this time I'd like to turn it over to Reggie Worlds, who will present the program items and services that we provide at Veterans Affairs. Reggie.
Mr. Worlds, thank you for coming. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Reggie Worlds. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Programs and Services side of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Prior to my presentation, if you take a look at our slide presentation here, we're going to have our finance director come down and provide an overview of our budget.
Thank you.
Ms. Krumschreiter? Schrader, is that correct?
Krumschroeder.
If you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed, that'd be great.
Good afternoon. I am Sherry Krumscher. I'm the finance director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And today, I'll just talk briefly about the overall budget of the Department of Veterans Affairs. We currently have our 10 and 11 biennial budget at $217 million. And of that, approximately 86% is for our Veterans Home Program, and the other 16% is for our Veterans Services Program. And as we go through the overview provided by the two deputy commissioners, they will share some of the information on the programs that are covered under each of our budget program areas. Did you have any specific questions regarding our budget?
Give us the overall, and we'll ask questions at the end if we can do that. And unless there's questions in between as we go through, there can be some questions asked, but we'll try and save our questions for the end if that's possible, members.
Okay.
If there's an urgent question, let me know.
All right, Mr. Chair. And as of right now, I was just going to provide the general overview that our department's budget is $217 million. And
thank you.
Approximately... ...54% of that would be general fund dollars. And we also have a general fund open appropriation for our Minnesota GI Bill, which is about 1% or $2.5 million. Our special revenue funds equate to about 15%, and our federal operating at 16% of that total budget, as well as federal construction dollars for our veterans' homes at 11%. The resident trust account, which is our trust for our residents at our five state-operated veterans' homes, is approximately 2%. And our donations or gift account contains about 1% of our annual operating budget.
Mr. Worrells.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about Veterans Affairs, who we are, and what we do. I will keep my remarks brief and give you a very general look at the department and then answer any questions you may have. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs was created in 1943 to meet the needs of the Minnesota's veterans, their dependents, and survivors by assisting them in securing those state and federal benefits to which they're entitled. We accomplish this mission by providing leadership and direction to the veteran community, as well as offering a myriad of benefits and services. Our State Soldiers Assistance Program provides direct or emergency financial assistance to veterans, dependents, and survivors. Assistance may include shelter, utilities, optical and dental assistance, cash grants, education benefits for veterans and war orphans, and special needs cases. Our LinkVet is a nation-leading program that provides information to veterans' benefits, health care, education, and reintegration. This is a phone line that is managed by trained Minnesota online staff during business hours, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Sunday. Our Veterans Preference Act ensures that state-granted veterans preference rights are upheld and enforced. The state approving agency provides administrative oversight of the federal GI Bill's education and training programs. Before veterans receive their GI Bill education benefits, the education or training program in which they are intended to enroll must be pre-approved by this agency. OJT and apprenticeship program. This program was transferred to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs from DALI on October 1st, 2008. This program provides increased opportunities for veterans to use their earned educational benefits for on-the-job and apprenticeship training. Our higher education veterans program supports veterans, current military members, and families at Minnesota colleges and universities. It provides on-campus veteran resource centers, comprehensive information about benefits and resources, as well as institutional readiness in support of the unique needs of these students. The Minnesota GI Bill provides post-secondary educational assistance to eligible Minnesota veterans, military members, and the children and spouses of deceased or severely disabled Minnesota veterans. This program is a last dollar in program. The Surviving Spouse Independent Education Benefit, also commonly known as the War Survivor Benefit, is provided to survivors of Minnesota veterans who died as a result of service-connected injury or disease. We provide federal claims assistance at both our St. Paul and Fargo claims office. Our staff represents veterans, their dependents, and survivors seeking benefits from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Responsibilities include claims development, submittal of evidence in support of service connection claims, pension assistance, evaluation of VA decisions, and assisting veterans and dependents with appeals processes up into and including federal hearings. Our outreach and women veterans programs helps locate and assist minority, female, and homeless veterans. Advocates on behalf of veterans having claims with the USDVA, acts as a liaison to various state and federal programs that provide veterans benefits, including health care programs, substance abuse programs, and housing, and responds to the gender-specific needs of our women veterans. The Tribal Veterans Service Officer provide community outreach to Minnesota's Native American veterans. They serve as a Native American advocate and monitors both federal and state benefit claims on their behalf. The Minnesota CORE programs serves veterans, current military, and their families through case management, outreach, referral, and education. It is a new nation-leading program designed to bring community-based services directly to veterans, service members, and families at no cost. We partnered with Lutheran Social Services to provide this service, and services include individual, family, financial, and debt management counseling, in addition to addiction, disability services, and in-service counseling. Our Minnesota State Veterans Cemetery is located in Little Falls and provides dignified burial services to veterans and their eligible dependents. Our recently separated veterans program assists veterans who have identified Minnesota as their home of record. Upon receipt of a DD-214 from any branch of service, MDVA mails a welcome home letter to the veteran. This letter contains relevant transitional information and directs them to their local county veterans service officer for available services. We also provide an enhancement grant that are used to enhance the benefits programs and services provided to veterans. This grant is provided to county veterans service officers to reach the goal of heightening awareness of their offices, services that they provide, and also the programmatic goals under which they may apply are outreach to veterans, reintegration of combat veterans, collaboration with social service agencies, educational institutions, and other relevant community resources, reduction of homelessness among veterans, digital records management, which is a form of veterans information database, transportation programs, marketing, advertising, staff management, and training. That concludes my briefing of the programs and services. I will take any questions that you may have.
Members, are there questions? Mr. Representative Anzalk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it would be wise considering the financial situation that we're in, that wherever appropriate and permissible, that we maximize federal financial participation for all of the programs and the mission, you know, of the department. My question is, I saw on the chart that 26% of the pie is federal financial participation. Is that based on a formula? Is it per capita? Is it retrospective? Do we bill the federal government for services rendered? Do all of the states get an equal share of federal financial participation? Just in general terms, how does that work,
Mr. Worrell?
With the idea being that we should be maximizing the federal government's share in our services to veterans.
Mr. Worrell.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, when we took a look at that budget slide, that is actually money that comes into the department with regards to programs. Our SAA, we receive federal funding that is fully funded by the federal government. We also, and Deputy Commissioner Acevedo will talk about the federal funding that comes in for the veterans homes. But with regards to maximizing the federal dollars, our claims office works hand in hand with our county veteran service officers to file those claims that veterans may have for injuries that were incurred in service or disabilities that were incurred in services or diseases that may have manifested or mental conditions that manifested in service in order to bring those dollars into the state. That money goes directly into the pockets of our veterans, which also reduces the need for our state resources to take care of these veterans. So these are entitlements. This is not cookie cutter. And each individual veteran, their case is different. So that's what we work hand in hand with our county partners in order to ensure that we're maximizing those benefits.
Representative Anzo, any follow-up?
No. Mr. Chair, if I could also add to that, Mr. Deputy Commissioner Worlds spoke to the federal dollars that our department brings into the state of Minnesota through our claims and outreach division. As far as the revenue chart that was shown earlier, that is specifically revenue brought into the department for our state approving agency, which is approximately $360,000 per year, as well as at our five state operated veterans homes. They're eligible for a veterans per diem, and that accounts for approximately 21% of our state operated veterans homes operating budget.
Representative Enzo.
Follow up, please. Does the 26% figure in your pie chart reflect in any way, shape, or form the federal share of long-term care provided to veterans or any other health-related benefit?
Ms. Combschroder?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, that does. That the 21% of our five state-operated veterans' homes do receive the VA per diem that I mentioned. That is the federal per diem for care for our veterans at our state veterans' homes. As well as we also currently have a number of awards in our federal construction grants at performing construction projects within our veterans' homes. And that accounts for, I think, of that 28%. I can give you the specific breakdown. 16% of our budget is for the operating, which would be the SAA program as well as the federal per diem. And then 11% would be directly for those construction grants in the current biennium.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to stop for now, but I think as we do our work this year, we ought to really pursue this whole area of how it is the state interfaces with federal funds and how to attract and draw down in order to maximize federal money.
Okay. Representative Creasel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Worlds, in regards to the Minnesota version of the GI Bill, what exactly does the last dollar in mean?
Mr. Worrells?
Mr. Chair, Representative Creasel, the last dollar in means that the veteran must have exhausted all other entitlements before he can apply for this benefit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Worrells, again, thank you for coming in. And I also serve on the Higher Education Committee, and we had Menskew in committee last week, and they have a big concern, and also at the MAG meeting this morning regarding the on-campus Veterans Resource Centers that we have and that we fund through the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that fund is going to sunset, I believe, in 2012. Is that about $2.5 million we're talking about for 2 years?
Mr. Worrells?
We would be looking at, Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, we'd be looking at about 2.1 for 2 years. The issue that we have with it sunsetting in 2012 is that it was originally supposed to sunset this year, 2011. It was extended a year, but we didn't receive additional funding to keep it going.
Mr. Chair, I understand that now, and if that fund is not brought back into effect with legislation here, when do you have to start cutting back on these programs, the college and universities, the resource centers? We need to realize that the colleges and universities are providing the space for these people to serve our veterans as they go through the lot of paperwork that's involved in the GI Bill, and there's most colleges don't understand the whole background on the Montgomery GI Bill and how and the different programs we have for our veterans. So when would you have to start cutting back if the funding is not brought back?
Mr. Worrells?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, if we were to sunset the program this year, after discussing this with my financial director or our department's financial director, we really would start having to look at cutting it back or eliminating the program next month. I mean, there will be some cost to shut the program down.
Right. Mr. Chair,
Representative,
and as Representative Enzel pointed out, we need to be looking at ways to keeping that federal money, because the Montgomery GI Bill is federal money coming into our state and to our local Menskew systems and universities. And so we really need to bring that up. I think this is something we need to take on pretty quickly, is reinstating the funding for that program. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to my colleagues here for bringing up these good points. My question, Commissioner, discussion of tribal veteran service officers, and how many of the tribes in the state have how many tribal veteran service officers are funded through the state at this time, if you know?
Mr. Worrells?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, we have 10 tribal veteran service officers across the state. We have one located up in Grand Portage, Red Lake, White Earth. We have two that are in the metro area. We have one that's in southwest Minnesota currently. It's vacant. And we also have one up in the northern area around I can't think of the reservation off the top of my head, sir. The program has been successful to this point. As you know, a lot of the Native Americans, they have a distrust of government, and we hired this group of individuals and trained them. They're veterans themselves to work in the communities that they live in and, provide that advocacy that they need to build that trust that we so desperately need to help them to get the benefits that they've earned.
Thank you.
Representative Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Worrells, I represent Morrison County, which in the heart of Morrison County is the Minnesota State Veterans Cemetery. It's a beautiful facility, and I encourage everybody here to visit it if you have the opportunity. But my question is this. Do you know if there's any status of building another state veterans cemetery in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Worrells.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, yes, sir, there is some legislation where we are looking at trying to build some cemeteries across the state. There's legislation to look in the Northeast, the Southwest, and the Southeast. We continue to look for viable land to bury our nation's heroes. It has become somewhat of a challenge to do so. We've looked at several sites, and of course there's lots of testing that needs to be done with each site that we go to. The language that was put in place allows us really to utilize some of the funding to test these sites in the original location, which was Northeast. We're going to have to look to change that language so that we'll be able to kind of use that money across the state so that when we find suitable locations, we'll be able to provide that testing that's necessary in hopes of finding a suitable place.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lemire.
Do you know if there's any federal dollars still available for building veterans?
Mr. Worrells.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, there is an application process that's out there. So the funding is there. There's matching funds that are utilized when we build a cemetery. There's so much that's paid by the federal government, and then the state government gets reimbursed for that. For the technical questions on that, I would like to refer that to our cemetery director, who is our subject matter expert. But if you have any specific questions, sir, I will be most certainly happy to get those answered for you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Worrells. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Worrells or for Ms. Crumb-Schroeder? I'm hoping that you'll stick around because I'm sure there'll be other people here, but we'll have Mr. Acevedo come and share some more about the Veterans Affairs Department in his area of expertise. Thank you. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself at the tape, we'd appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gilbert Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare. I, too, want to thank the committee and the chair for giving me the opportunity to present the Department of Veteran Affairs, Veterans Homes component of our department. The Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs State Veterans Homes program has been around since the 1800s, 1887, shortly after the Civil War. The homes were identified as the Old Soldiers Home. And it was a place for veterans or those soldiers coming back from the Civil War to enjoy time and life in a peaceful and a nice, quiet place where they can retire. Through the years, the Old Soldiers Home, there was a understanding or determination that they needed to provide some medical care. Originally, it was designed as a place of residence for our residents, for our veterans to reside. And through the years, they determined that they needed to start providing medical care. Around the 1960s, the nursing home care or long-term care started to be implemented or introduced. Through the 70s, additional buildings were built to provide nursing home care. And today, we have 5 veterans homes throughout the state. The veterans homes are located in Fergus Falls, Hastings, Laverne, Minneapolis, and Silver Bay. And we're divided up into 2 categories, veterans homes and, nursing homes and domiciliary care. The nursing home characteristics, average age of our nursing home residents are 78, predominantly male. That's changing a little bit, but most of the residents are male. They're World War II veterans, and the main diagnosis, 3 top diagnoses for these residents is Alzheimer's disease, dementia with behavioral disturbance, and organic brain syndrome, which is chronic. We also have, in the state of Minnesota, the opportunity to admit the spouse of a veteran at our veterans' homes, and they would need to show a medical need or medical necessity to be admitted there, and they have to be 55 years of age or older. Our domiciliary, which is also known as boarding care, The resident characteristics for our domiciliary average age is 58. The majority of our residents predominantly are male. We're starting to see some females being admitted to our homes. And they're Vietnam veterans, but we are showing some admissions of current war veterans coming into our homes as well. And the top three diagnoses or care that we provide is alcohol dependence syndrome, schizophrenia, and affective psychosis secondary to depression. And oftentimes they're homeless when they come, but that's not always the case. In our skilled nursing facility, some of our residents that come there move from nursing home to nursing home, so they've had multiple nursing home stays prior to coming into our veterans home as kind of a final place where they can come and rest and call it their home. I'll go through each of our homes as the department goes by, and I'll explain a little bit about each of the homes. Our first home we have is the Minneapolis home. Was established in 1887. It's a 341 skilled bed and 61 domiciliary beds. We've had in 2007, one of our buildings, building 9, was deemed inhabitable, and so it was condemned, and we needed to tear the building down, and we're building a new home. As a result of that, we needed to move some of our residents from the domiciliary into our skilled nursing location, so they're occupying 50 beds. So at present, even though it says that we have 341 skilled beds and 61 domiciliary, actually we have a total of 341 beds on the campus as a whole. We have 18 buildings on 51-acre campus, private to semi-private rooms, and the administrator at the Minneapolis home is Shelley Kendrick. We have a number of construction projects going on there as well. As I mentioned, we have a new building 9. We're renovating one of the old 1800 building and turning it into a adult day, and then we're taking another one of our buildings, renovating that building, which is building 16, and occupying that with our domiciliary residents, moving them from skilled nursing beds over to domiciliary beds. The Hastings Veterans Home was established in 1978. This was an old state hospital located at Hastings that was converted into a veterans home. It's a 200-bed domiciliary. It is exclusively a domiciliary operation. Does not have nursing home or skilled nursing beds there. It sits on 128-acre campus. Chemical dependency, counseling, rehab. We have a wood shop that's there. The residents that are there, as I mentioned at the beginning, they're predominantly Vietnam veterans or younger, 58 years of age is the average. And the interim administrator is Robin Gusted. The Silver Bay home was established in 1991. The Silver Bay Veterans Home sits in the North Shore, and it is the Silver Bay Veterans Home was an old middle school that was converted to a veterans home. During the renovation, we needed to put a new roof on there and several other components, but still the veterans home looked like an old middle school. When you walk down the halls, it gave you the feel like you were needing to go see the principal. And we've gone through a pretty extensive renovation where we've gutted out the inside of the building, and we're turning it into more of a person-centered care where the residents are living in a home-like environment. That should be completed this spring. It's a 83 skill bed. We have dementia units, about 25 beds that are specifically for dementia. The 50 miles to northeast Duluth is important to note, only because that is when we have to take our residents for appointments or medical care. That's quite a distance that they have to travel for care from a location as isolated as Silver Bay. And the administrator is Carol Gilbertson.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, I would like to just thank you, Mr. Chair. And my wife and I have a cabin up in Silver Bay, so I've toured the facility twice, and Carol Gilbertson has just done an excellent job managing that facility. And back when I was there, that community there is very involved in the facility and with the veterans there. I know that the area churches provide church services. They take turns providing church services on Sunday. And in fact, I actually went out fishing with some of the veterans as we got on a bus, and they took us out fishing. There's a local pond that a landowner has up there, and he has it set up for the veterans to get there and do their fishing and get them back on campus. So, Carol Gilbertson has done an excellent job there. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, thank you for your comments. You're absolutely right. The staff that we have are just absolutely phenomenal, and the partnership that we have in the community with each of our veterans' homes is really a great partnership with volunteerism. Veteran service organizations provide a number of volunteer hours and funding to help our veterans be able to do that. But it's very impressive.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, that's a new metal roof on that facility, because they get a lot of snow up there, mm-hmm. and the metal roof really comes in handy. So.
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Laverne Veterans Home was established in 1994, Southwest Minnesota. 85-bed skilled nursing has a Wanda unit during the Wanda unit and dementia that was established through partnering with federal and state dollars. And the administrator is Michael Bond. The Fergus Falls Veterans Home was established in 1997. It's 85 skilled nursing beds. It has a community-based outpatient clinic within the complex that's unique in many ways, that you have a federal clinic inside a state veterans home, and that allows veterans in the community to come to the veterans home and seek care at that community-based outpatient clinic. The staff at the community-based outpatient clinic are from the federal government, from the United States Department of Veteran Affairs. But the other thing that was unique with that particular community-based outpatient clinic is that it's a nurse practitioner-run community-based outpatient clinic. It was the first in the nation to do that. It has a interior open-air recreational area. The award-winning nursing care approach, this is where we have nursing and some of our staff which are in a universal worker setup, where they can provide nursing assistance, but they can also help with dietary needs, housekeeping needs, and several others. And that's in a person-centered care approach, so that you keep your staff that are working closely with those residents and their family members, so they know who they're working with every day. And it works really well. Administrator is John Skillingstead there. We have an active waiting list at all of our homes, with the exception of Hastings. Fergus Falls currently has 154-person waiting list. We have a construction project going on at the Fergus Falls, which is a 21-bed special care unit, and that is so that we can accommodate the people that are on, the veterans that are on the waiting list, but also is for dementia and Alzheimer's care. And I will say that all of our projects, I have mentioned construction projects several times here, we receive federal funding to go with that as well. So as an example, when we there are several ways that this can be accomplished. We can ask for a project, and then if we get the one-third or the 35% for that funding for that project, we can submit an application, and the federal government will pay 65% for that project, for building costs and things of that nature. But if the state pays 100% for a project, we then submit, once the project is completed, we submit reimbursement from the federal government to reimburse the state for the 65% of the actual cost of that project. So there are different ways we try to capitalize on bringing as many federal dollars into the state as possible. The Laverne Veterans Home has 88 people on the waiting list. Minneapolis, which is the largest waiting list and the largest facility we have, has a 207 person waiting list, and Silver Bay currently at 66. The another note about funding with the VA per diem that we receive for our veterans' homes comes from the federal government, and that VA per diem is a per day amount that depending on the level of care. So it's different for skilled nursing than that what it would be for domiciliary. And we receive those for every day that those veterans are currently in our nursing homes or in our domiciliaries. If they're not there in a hospital or at home on leave, we wouldn't get that per diem amount for that day. But we are currently in the process of working on Medicare certification at our veterans' homes. Veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota have not been Medicare certified. We're hopeful that we'll be Medicare certified with the Minneapolis home, our largest home here in the very near future. We'll be able to then bill for services through Medicare to bring additional federal dollars. And we are looking at creating a centralized pharmacy for all of our veterans' homes to operate. We are having opportunity to tap into federal schedule or federal funding to purchase our pharmaceuticals for our veterans, and then we will be able to bill third-party payers and also bill Medicare Part D, as an example. So, with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I stand ready for your questions.
Representative Ann Zelk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great presentation, very helpful.
Thank you, sir.
My question has to do with indigent veterans. I assume that federal VA funds reimburse 100% of the cost of care in a skilled nursing bed. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansel, not necessarily. What happens is there is a formula. And for those veterans that are 70% service-connected or higher, the VA will reimburse 100% of the cost of care or the prevailing rate, whichever is less in the state. And so they will pay for those. Those veterans that are indigent and have no funds, the ability to pay at the veterans' home is based on your ability to pay. So the state picks up the portion of that, but so does the federal government through the VA per diem. We also have members in our veterans' homes that are known as benefit coordinators, and then they look to see, they work with the veteran to see what kind of benefits they can receive through the federal VA, and so they may be able to be entitled to a compensation to help offset some of the costs as well. So there are ways that we can assist that, but to say that the VA will pay for 100% of the care for an indigent resident, not necessarily. The state pretty much pays for that.
Follow-up, Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was a great, very, very helpful. Therefore, it would appear to me that it makes really good sense to get Medicare certified beds wherever and whenever we can, so that Medicare could become the secondary funding source in partnership with the VA. Does that make sense?
Mr. Acevedo?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansel, there are probably 500 ways I can answer that question, but I'll answer it.
I only need one.
I'll answer it carefully. Yes, okay. In partial thought, but what we have with our rules for our veterans' homes, there is a date of application that is a requirement. So our residents are admitted in our homes by date of application. So Medicare, in order for us to use Medicare Part A, which is their hospital benefit, or Medicare Part B, if a resident comes to us from their home, they would not be qualified for Medicare Part A because they don't have a qualifying stay at a hospital. So we wouldn't be able to tap into those dollars. Medicare Part B is your outpatient rehab or outpatient type services. So if they're in there requiring skilled care or nursing care, it wouldn't qualify for Medicare Part B either. Then the final piece of this, which I was hoping to stay away from, but I think it's important to mention, is medical assistance or Medicaid. Mm-hmm. The state of Minnesota has a very unique and strong bill legislation that protects the assets of veterans and their families to keep veterans or their families to become impoverished. So that we have a one-day look back at our veterans' homes, whereas if you become Medicaid certified, they can go back and have a five-year look back for all of your assets. And so that would become kind of a problem if they become Medicaid certified, Medicaid eligible, so then it ends up possibly impoverishing the family. So we don't have that as a requirement. I will say that there are some veterans that already are on medical assistance, Medicaid, and we use that benefit as much as we can, but across the board, that's not necessarily the case.
Just a comment, we are really, really fortunate to have your service because that was very helpful.
Thank you, sir. Thank
you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at one of the last slides talking about the waiting lists around the states for access to veterans' homes, I know that there's always kind of a push to figure out which community might be the likely recipient of the next veterans' home. And I believe the department has done some work to go and identify priorities. And I know Representative Kuhn and I have authored legislation for what we think would be a good facility in Montevideo, but we also want to go and make sure that, you know, not just injecting our own personal biases, but to really let the department offer up its objective view about where these next homes should be. So with that, I'd like to see if you have some of these priority lists put together, or just kind of your thoughts on that. And then to talk about the discussion, because as you mentioned, the federal government will often pay for a significant portion. I believe it was 65% is what was stated. Was it as high as 80% in the past? If we can afford to bond for those types of projects, but then can you also reconcile that with the operating costs, and how do we make sure that if we build a facility, it's used, and we can make sure that we have the staff there that these veterans do get the care that they need? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, the priority lists that the department last year during our session, the House recommended that we conduct a study. And the study basically looked at the state, and the question that was asked was, if we were to build another veterans home, where would we build a future veterans home, given a number of rules that are out there? For example, one of the rules that the VA has in place, that in order for us to receive building costs and to receive VA per diem, we cannot be within 110 miles of another existing veterans home. That's just one example. So there are several components to that question. And we conducted the study. We looked at the demographics. We looked at the possibility of future veterans in that particular area. And we came up with a list of 17 locations. And we made it as clear as possible that any of those 17 locations could have a veterans home. And so just because you came out as number one, if I recall, number one on the list was Little Falls, doesn't necessarily mean that Little Falls will get a veterans home. So we have taken a stance as a department that when it comes to future veterans homes, we are neutral. That is really up to the legislature and the governor to decide where a future veterans home would go. But the component of this that we feel very strongly about and don't feel that we're so neutral is that if a future veterans home is built, then funding for that home needs to accompany the building of that home. Because if we take funding from our existing homes to offset the cost of that other home, then we're taking services away from veterans, and that's going to hurt veterans. And I would like to use an example that last year, actually in 2008, we had a couple legislators, one from the House, one from the Senate, that co-authored a bill to help Fergus Falls get to 21-bed extension or expansion to their facility. And that was great because we needed the help for dementia care and Alzheimer's care. As we prepared the documents, it identified what the cost would be, the tails, to pay for that facility in the out years. We were very fortunate in that the federal government received stimulus money to help their construction list. So we were moved up on the construction list very quickly. So in 2009, we received the funds to build that additional 21 bed. When that happened, we went back to the legislature and asked, okay, we're building it, so now we need to start talking about the startup costs for that so we can hire our staff and outgoing costs. And we were told on a couple of occasions, House and Senate, that we had to find it within our own existing funds because we just don't have the funds to do that. So it concerns me that if we build another, a future veterans home somewhere, which is, again, I'm not opposed to that, but if we build it and then we don't fund it, it becomes very difficult to operate the home at that point.
Representative Fault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner, for that very broad-reaching and well-thought-out and well-spoken answer. And I appreciate the work the department has done there. And I just also want to iterate that, I mean, I think that it's very clear to us that we have these waiting lists, so there is definitely a demand, and some people maybe prefer the veterans home option, some people prefer something more local, but just the numbers you present really shows that there is a need and you're doing a good job. And with that, I do also understand that there is a need for resources, because I do think that there's going to be, at least I feel, some strong direction to try to find at least another site and to build another veterans home. I mean, the ability to do multiple things, provide the care, provide the facilities. Well, we're also looking at creating jobs, and that's one way that I think that we can all be benefit from this. But to also look at, like, you're completely right about having the fact that we need to go and have the budget, we need to have the resources there to provide for the care. And so whatever you can do to let us know what it's going to take for resources, please share that, because this is absolutely a priority area, and we want to make sure that those resources are provided.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioners and Commissioner or Acting Commissioner Shalito, thank all of you for being here, as well as the Finance Director. This has been very informative for newer members to the committee, and we're kind of getting a crash course on a number of things. But I want to go back to one thing that you said, and Deputy Commissioner Worlds, if you could just go back to the previous slide before this. And one of the things that you had said when we're going through the different facilities, you had indicated that the predominant population is males. How are you addressing female veterans' needs, and are most of the people that are on this list female veterans?
Mr. Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the number of, I don't know off the top of my head whether they're male or female that are on the waiting list. We can find that out very easily. We have had numerous discussions about how are we going to address the issue or the concern for women veterans coming into our veterans' homes. We do know that the day is going to come where we will have an equal amount, given the number of veterans, women veterans that are serving today and that have served over the past few years, several years. It really isn't much of a concern or a problem for us in a nursing home arena, where we see it that we are looking at changing programming, which we're doing right now, and looking at developing a future or strategic planning is at the Hastings home, because the Hastings home is more of an independent or assisted type living, boarding care. And when if we have veterans that are women veterans that are homeless or that need our services, it may be accompanying several other diagnoses and things that we need to deal with. And then we also need to understand that women veterans will have unique care issues that are specific. So we are dealing with that right now. We are talking about it. We are working through it through strategic planning. I can certainly let Deputy Commissioner Worlds mention this, but he is in the process of hiring a women veteran, a director for women's veterans and employment. And so we're excited to have a person on our team that's going to focus very specifically on women veterans, even though we do it now, but now we're going to have an expert in the field.
Representative O'Driscoll.
One more question, Mr. Chair. We all recognize that that's going to be a growing part of the population. In the short time that I've been here, just the individuals that have been walking the State Office Building and the Capitol Building that are obviously service-connected, a number of them are female in a ratio of their male counterparts that are here. And so I think that's something we do need to keep track of, and perhaps that's something you're thinking about as well, as Representative Falk had indicated, with a future facility as well. Thank you.
Mr. Acevedo, any other comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to the committee today.
I do have a few questions. Are there any federal homes, quote, federal homes versus state veterans' homes in the country?
Mr. Chair, yes. In fact, we have in Washington, D.C., there is an Army... The name of the home escapes me. I'm sorry? Army Soldiers and Sailors. Our military. Army Soldiers and Sailors home. And I know that there's another one in Mississippi as well.
Have there been any recommendations to have a federal veterans' homes in other states other than those locations?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the details to that. I can certainly find out to see what the... I do know that when I was in the service, a portion of my pay was taken to support these homes. It was 50 cents a paycheck or something like that. But that was used to help support and fund these homes. But I can get more detail on those particular homes in the next opportunity I have. I can present it at this committee, or I can give it to you directly, sir.
The active, I think something already mentioned about the active waiting lists, and I'm just curious. I see here in Minneapolis and Hastings that there is a no wait. And I'm just, I would think of all places, because they're more populated, that you would have a waiting list there. And if you can give me some idea of background on why.
Yes, Mr. Chair. At the Minneapolis home, it's for the domiciliary that there is a no waiting list. And Hastings, there is no waiting list either. It's a tough environment, because there's several stigmas that are surrounding those veterans coming into either Hastings or the Minneapolis domiciliary. Some of it is that they're homeless. There's mental health issues, and we are working closely with our federal partners and others to try to get the word out about our veterans home in Hastings. But I know that, for example, we can bring in a veteran that is homeless into our domiciliary. After a period of time, they will discharge or self-discharge back to homelessness. Or to someplace else, because there are too many rules, or they just have a difficult time adjusting in a environment where we have counselors and we have rules, we have expectations, and those types of things. But that is a concern of ours. We do see it as a problem, because we know we have veterans that are homeless. We know that we have veterans that may need our services. The other component to that is they need to be able or eligible for admission into our home. So we go through an eligibility to make sure that we can provide the care. So if we have a veteran that we cannot provide the care, their care exceeds our ability to care for them, it would be a disservice to them, as well as it would be a disservice to the other veterans, to admit them into our home and then find that we can't care for them.
Skilled nursing care, the workers that work in these veterans homes and with the Veterans Affairs, are they all state employees, or is there dividing, just like my being a part of the Minnesota Air National Guard? I was 75% paid for by the Fed funds, and the other part was by state funds. How is that meted out for those people that are working for the homes as well as for Veterans Affairs?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at the veterans' homes, the majority of our staff are state employees, and they're paid by the state. However, we do have contracted staff, and those are either very specialties, such as maybe a psychiatrist, psychologist, and some of our other services that we may go into with contracting. In those cases, we pay their salary through the contract. At our homes that are in the outstate, such as Fergus Falls, Laverne, and Silver Bay, we contract with physician services because we're unable to attract and hire a physician to be part of that home. And it works better for us in that fashion as well. So the physician services are contracted, as an example. Pharmaceutical services at our outstate homes, until we can develop our centralized pharmacy, a good portion of those are also under professional or technical contracts as well.
As some people have noticed in the past year, and maybe years gone by, there's been stories that have been written in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about the vets' home in Hastings and the vets' home in Minneapolis. And the one that comes up to mind right now is the recent loss of the administrator at the Hastings home. I'm wondering what that situation was. Are those administrators, are they a state employee? Are they hired by? What's the criteria for bringing those people on, and what's the criteria for letting them go, and who makes that final decision?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Veterans Homes leadership, the administrators, are required to have a license to operate the home. We operate the home with their license, so they're nursing home administrators, and the license is provided by the state of Minnesota. And our director of nursing for the Hastings home, as an example, is also licensed, a licensed registered nurse, and so she is responsible for the oversight or to look through and ensure nursing care at that home. The administrators work at the pleasure of the commissioner, and so that's the commissioner, and then they work for the deputy commissioner, which is delegated down to the deputy commissioner to monitor and oversee the operations of the homes. The ultimate responsibility for the hiring and dismissal of those employees is a discussion between the deputy commissioner and the commissioner, but ultimately it's the commissioner's decision to make that decision. And it's not an easy decision to make. Because when you hire someone into the home, you want to make sure there's continuity and consistency in the home. And Mr. Chair, you mentioned a couple things that are very important that I feel it's important to point out. Whenever we have an issue that happens at our veterans' homes, they can hit the newspaper, hit the evening news, be called in for a legislative hearing, and there's multiple things that can happen as a result of something happening at the home, as it should be. I want to make sure our veterans are treated with the utmost respect and care and dignity. The problem that we run into, or the concern that I have, is that once this happens, we then have difficulty attracting and hiring a future administrator at our home, because it's their livelihood that we're talking about with their license. And once someone is either dismissed for cause or does not complete their employment at a veterans home, they need to try to go back into the community in Minnesota and try to be hired at a nursing home for that. And I can use an example that recently at Hastings, the federal VA, it was a local constituent that wrote to Senator Franken. Senator Franken asked the VA to look into what was happening at Hastings, and the allegation was that the staff, in particular the director of nursing, was retaliating against the veterans at the veterans home. The federal VA came in to conduct their survey, which they called an inspection, but there's a difference between an inspection team and a survey team. And the survey team, they come in, they look for medical care. An inspection team will look at any wrongdoing that's happening and then just follow through with that. And what took place here is that a survey team came in, they asked a question of a veteran, of several veterans, if you complain about your care, do you feel you would be retaliated against? The resident said yes. And so they ended the investigation at that point, and they felt that it was substantiated. We then, once we received that information, it didn't come directly to us. It came to us through Senator Franken 2 months later. I initiated an investigation there at the home to get some more detail. And so upon completion of our investigation, we found, we asked not only if you complain about your care, do you feel you'd be retaliated against, but then asked the next question, have you been retaliated against, or do you know anyone that has been retaliated against, and can you give us some examples? And so the residents were not able to exactly point out how they were retaliated against, and in some cases, they didn't even know the director of nursing, although they said they felt that they were being retaliated against. So I think it was a situation of reputation, and based on that investigation, we did find that the staff were being retaliated against, and we substantiated that, but were not able to substantiate that the residents were being retaliated against.
Any other questions for the department? Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your coming forth and giving us the overview, and we'll hopefully be in touch with you in the next few weeks and months, and maybe we'll have you back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a gentleman from the audience. Mr. Sir, we'll have questions at the end. Yeah. If I could bring our next testifier forward from the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers, there's some piece of literature in your or the pages are handing them out right now, and if the gentleman who's going to be representing the Veteran Service Officer could state for the record his name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Milt Schoen. I'm the Hennepin County Veteran Service Officer, and I'm also the legislative chair of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. County Veteran Service Officers are mandated under state law, and we are virtually entirely supported by property tax. And the system was set up so that no matter where a veteran lived within our state, they would be able to have access to both federal benefits and state benefits and have someone assist them in obtaining the benefits. We work with both veterans and their dependents to obtain benefits for them. We primarily are focused on obtaining VA compensation for those veterans with service-connected disabilities, VA pension for both veterans and surviving spouses who are eligible for that, and health care. Those are major issues that that bring veterans to our door, and for other benefits, including state benefits. We partner with the VA regional office. We've got many partners, and nobody does their work by themselves. They're a great partner for us. They've helped train and educate our county veteran service officers so that we've got some of the best in the nation in terms of writing claims. We've got a great partnership with the VA healthcare system. We have hospitals in Minneapolis and St. Cloud. We also have hospitals in Fargo and Sioux Falls that serve Minnesota. We've got 9 community-based outpatient clinics that serve our veterans in the state, and there's another one that will be coming online within the year. We have our Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs that has an array of state benefits, and we work with them to make sure that we're securing those state benefits for our veterans. Virtually all of our compensation claims and pension claims we send into our partners, into claims offices at the VA regional office. And we've got the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs American Legion Claims Office that many of our claims go to. Those individuals are state employees and receive state benefits. We have other partners that we work with, the Veterans of Foreign Wars Claims Office, the Disabled American Veterans, the Military Order Purple Heart, and those organizations receive a stipend that comes through the Department of Veterans Affairs budget, and they are also partners in us in working on the claims process. We try to address the most important issues that are confronting the veterans in the state. And since 2007, when we had the mass deployment of the Red Bulls to Iraq, we've helped over 7,600 Minnesota veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. We're there at Fort McCoy or wherever they're demobilized. We sign them up for VA health care for their 90-day dental. And we also do a combat theater questionnaire. We send the information back to their counties so that when these veterans return, they're connected to services. I see Bob Davis, my counterpart from Goodhue County, who's a Goodhue County County Veteran Service Officer. This weekend, he was working with a number of other County Veteran Service Officers with the 2,400 Red Bulls and their families who will be going to Iraq, and we will be helping those people demobilize in another year. An example of why this is important, in the past we've had veterans that came to us after their 90 days expired. They weren't able to get their 90-day dental. We've had a great partnership with the Minnesota National Guard, with the Red Bulls, and we've developed partnerships with the reserves to make sure that we're able to connect with these individuals as they return. In 2007, nationwide, 30% of the Guard and Reserve troops who returned from Iraq signed up for VA health care. In Minnesota, since 2007, 99% of the Minnesota National Guard troops have signed up for VA health care. And I think that's a result of the efforts of our County Veteran Service Officers, and we're very proud of that. 85 to 90% of the original claims for VA compensation, for service-connected compensation, in Minnesota that go through our regional office are originated by County Veteran Service Officers. And I think a higher percentage of the claims for state benefits that go into the state come from our County Veteran Service Officers. To give you a sense of scope, Minnesota veterans received $721 million in VA service-connected compensation and VA pension every year. There's $767 million in health care that our veterans receive in this state. Much of that is due to the work of our County Veteran Service Officers. One of the things we do is to make sure that our veterans access their federal benefits. And one of the things that this does is it reduces the amount of money that our state pays for medical assistance and other programs, and it reduces the property tax that our counties pay when they provide these services if they weren't provided through the VA. One of the major things, as I mentioned, we do is to access health care, and especially in an economy like this, it's critical. And our CVSOs see more people needing health care as they may be laid off, as employment is more challenging, and that's one of the issues we work with. We work on long-term care. We have VA long-term care benefits for wartime veterans, and we work with them for wartime veterans, and we work with them to get those benefits. The Millennium Act was mentioned. We work to help people receive those benefits if they're eligible for the benefits, and we also work to get people in Minnesota veterans homes. Much of our work is working with individuals who may be in the shadow of life. We work with many people who have issues with chemical dependency and mental health issues, and that's one of the great resources of the VA healthcare system. There's tremendous resources that are put in to our veterans, and we want to make sure that the needs of those individuals are addressed. On transportation, many of our counties, especially in greater Minnesota, have vans and they provide transportation. And any day you go to the Minneapolis VA Medical Center, you'll see 30 vans from throughout the state bringing veterans into our VA Medical Center and making sure that those individuals get the health care that they need. And in many of those counties, they have vans that run to more than one medical center. They may go to St. Cloud, they may go to Minneapolis, and some of them provide transportation to the community-based outpatient clinics. We have many unique initiatives that happen throughout our state to address the needs of the specific veterans in our county. In my county, we initiated a veterans court in July of 2010. I think that's an initiative that will probably be moving forward in the future. And there are many other things that happen at a county level. Some counties have a more elderly population. They're more focused on long-term care and nursing home care. Others are a further distance away from healthcare facilities, and there's an emphasis on transportation. But there is this understanding of the needs of the people in the local county and a response to that, and that's something that we do. And as I mentioned, we partner with the State Department of Veterans Affairs and with the VA regional office and with the VA healthcare system. And in our state, we're fairly unique. We have a partnership. There's a sense of working together to solve problems. And I want to thank you for your time and the ability for us to share what we do as County Veteran Service Officers with you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Schoen? Members, you have in your packet a copy of a report that was done a year or two ago in response to a report that came out by the Office of Legislative Auditor. And this is a report, I think, Representative Coonan, you were involved with this, or you had some, it was during your time where you were the chair of the subdivision, if I can.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie actually led this group.
Okay. But I see that on here in some of the working groups here that Mr. Schoen was a part of some of these recommendations, oversight groups regarding improving state oversight back to the legislature on working between the Veterans Affairs and CVSOs, and then he was also on training and education, making recommendations back to the legislature in terms of better cooperation with the CVSOs and the Department of Veterans Affairs. I don't know if you have any comments on your work there with that report and your ongoing relationship with the veterans.
Well, we support the report, and it was a long journey to work through some of the issues that had come up in the Legislative Auditor's Report. The Legislative Auditor's Report in itself was largely favorable. There were certain parts of it that we took exception to, and as always, it's challenging with a system as complex as ours when you're dealing with external partners to be able to convey, you know, the work that you do and what we accomplish. But we're we had our members. I served on that. Our president served on it. And vice president, and we were satisfied with the recommendations that were put forth from the CVSO work group.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoen, when you began here today, you referenced funding, if I recall correctly, for the County Veteran Service Office. Yeah, could you say that again? I want to make sure I understand where the funding is.
Mr. Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, we are county employees, and we're mandated by the state, and virtually of all of our funding comes from property tax. You know, there may be a little bit of grant fund here and there that counties get, but basically we're funded by the property tax at a county level, and that's what we rely upon.
Mr. Purcell?
Just, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be perfectly clear, so you don't get any funding, or if it is, it's grant funding or whatever, to the state veterans?
Mr. Schoen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, the state has had some grants, and they've got two different types of grants that were available and are available to county veteran service officers. And many counties have received funds, you know, from those grants. and that is a source of revenue, but it is not a primary source of revenue. Most of our revenue comes from the property tax.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get clear on, is it a reliable source of funding, the grant through the state?
Mr. Wurls.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, currently we have two grants that are provided to the CVSOs from the state of Minnesota, one of them being the operational grant, which is a grant that helps the CVSOs to operate their offices, update technology. That is granted to the counties on a triennial basis, meaning there's 87 counties. Every 3 years, counties are provided the opportunity to apply for that grant. We also have a CVSO enhancement grant, which is due to sunset this year, and that grant has been utilized to help the county veteran service officers enhance the services provided in their offices. Some counties have hired, you know, staff on a two-year basis. Some have bought vans. Some have upgraded their information systems. It's used to heighten awareness in the community through marketing campaigns, you know, things along that lines. The grants have been funded for the past 2 years at about $750,000. On the enhancement side, it's about $98,000 on the operational side. Both have proven to really improve the services that they have out in the counties, and we would like to see them continue.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Schoen. In terms of training your county service officers, are they trained prior to getting hired, or do you hire them, and then do they go off to training, and who conducts the training?
Mr. Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, CVSOs are trained once they begin the job. We have some who are assistants who already know that, and they get promoted to become a county veteran service officer in another county. I myself was an assistant for 10 years before I became a county veteran service officer in Hennepin. Whenever a person is hired, there's training. I've just had several of my staff go to advanced basic training that the State Department of Veterans Affairs puts on. Last June, we were fortunate enough to have the National Association of County Veteran Service Officers training here, and virtually every CVSO in the state attended that training, and it was like 32 hours worth of classroom training. The first time you attend that, you've got to pass a closed book test. There's a lot of training that goes on formally for our CVSOs, and we get there's a spring conference that the department puts on. There's a fall conference that our association puts on. Plus, there's a whole series of other trainings that go on, and that's very important because the VA healthcare system, the VA benefits administration, they're always changing, and we need to be up to date with those changes.
Thank you. I think Mr. Wurls got some comments on that, too.
Mr. Wurls?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative. Also, when a new service officer is hired, the department is charged with going out and meeting that new service officer and ensuring that we provide them with that initial in-office training, basically bringing up to speed with the duties of the position. We partner very closely with the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers to ensure that individual is up to speed on how to process claims, get people to the hospital, work with local agencies in order to provide the services necessary for the betterment of that veteran and his family. In addition to that, we also provide what we call an advanced basic training where we bring the new CVSO to the cities. We provide them some in-depth training that is combined with the association, with the federal VA, to include the VAMCs, to give them a more broader interpretation of what their duties are and the scope of their abilities. We work very closely with the association to bring the National Association of County Veteran Services Officers into town, their conference, to train the CVSOs. There's two tracks to that. There's a beginner's track and an advanced track. The CVSOs would go into whichever one, you know, would better suit their needs at that time. And then we have ongoing training. They have to to get ongoing credits for certification, 8 credits at our spring conference, 8 credits at their fall conference, and it's worked very well so far.
Senator Detmer?
Mr. Chair, and just finally, so but it's the department does the training, but it's still the county that has oversight and makes sure that the job is well done. Am I correct?
Mr. Worlds?
That is correct, sir.
Yeah. Mr. Schoen?
Yes, we are county employees, and there is this challenge that of training from other sources and getting training both from the federal and the state government.
Mr. Schoen, can you tell me how your role as a CVSO officer or the CVSOs in particular has changed over the years now that we have women coming back from the theaters?
Well, when I started, I think we had 2 female county veteran service officers. We've got about 115 county veteran service officers and assistants in our state, and I think today we've got 20 female county veteran service officers. So that's telling you, you know, that there has been a pretty significant change there. The new GI Bill has a very, very important element to it. The old GI Bill, you had 10 years to use it from your last date of entitlement. The new GI Bill gives you 15 years, and that clock gets reset if you're in the Guard or Reserve and you get deployed to the date of your last deployment. Well, if I'm a female soldier and I serve in Iraq and I come back, I very likely am going to start a family. And there may be 5 years where I'm raising my children until the point that they start school, until the point that I might be able to get an education. And by changing that law on a federal level and having the new GI Bill say, we're going to have 15 years, it's going to afford those women who are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan when they come back a better chance of getting their education because it takes that into account. And that's an example of one of the things. We've got women's clinics at the VA Medical Center. There is a desire to work with the veterans out there and to reach out to them, but there is a challenge. When we had a women's veterans reception after the first Gulf War, and we'd passed the Persian Gulf bonus, I was sitting with a female National Guard member who didn't think at that time that she was a veteran, even though she'd been called to support Desert Storm and she'd been sent down to Fort Sam Houston. Well, she was eligible for that bonus. I explained to her that she was eligible, but that was a process of getting people connected. And we've moved from, obviously the VA is a very male-dominated institution. In World War II, it was maybe 98% men served, and when I was in the military, it was maybe 95% male. And today, women comprise 14-15% of our force, and in some of our National Guard units, upwards of 20% in some of those units. So the institutions are changing. We've been changing to make sure that we're able to make sure people get the resources they need. And we're always working to look at what is coming up. We know we've got this batch of 2,400 that are going to Iraq that will be coming back. We work very hard to make sure we meet their needs, and we work with our partners at the VA hospital and the regional office and the State Department of Veterans Affairs to solve problems. When we had HUD-VASH vouchers, the VA Medical Center was able to obtain HUD-VASH vouchers, or scattered site rental vouchers for homeless veterans who will be case managed by the VA. You need to get something in return. You need to get some change in behavior for them to get this housing. We partnered with the State Department of Veterans Affairs, and they modified one of their programs so that we could get a damage deposit so that we could place these people into the housing so we'd get them off the street, they weren't going into our shelters or jails, and that they were able to move on with life. And That's one of the things that we've done and continue to do.
Mr. Worlds?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, with regards to the female veteran question that you posed, as we move forward and we start to take a look at the population, we're understanding that there's a lot of stigma involved with them. It is very difficult population to work with in terms of helping them to get to the services that they need because of the mindset that the VA and a lot of the services that are out there for male soldiers. But we're making some headway with that. We in the department, along with our partners on the federal and the county side, put on a female veteran summit a year ago or 2 years ago, and that was very well received, and we're hoping to continue that going forward. The department is also going to invest in a new position that is going to address the unique needs of women and also veterans' employment. We've identified a candidate. She should start working with us here in March, and her job is going to be to work with the community to find out what some of the unique needs are that are out there and to bring back ideas to us for us to take a look at and work with our federal and county partners to address those issues. In addition, we have two dedicated federal claims reps, both in our St. Paul office and in our Fargo office, that work specifically on women veterans' claims and their issues. So we are making some strides to address this issue. We're hoping to build that trust that's going to be necessary to bring them forward so that we can take care of them and make improvements as we go along.
Thank you. Any other questions? I know we're running out of time, and I've got another place to go at 2:15. So, gentlemen, thank you for being here. I did say that I would allow one question to come out of the audience here, so I'll do that quickly. If he would like to just come over to the microphone and ask the question, and we'll see what the response is, and then we need to move on. State your name for the...
My name is Charlie McAdon. I'm a disabled American veteran, former employee of the old VA hospital, Minneapolis, former employee of the new VA hospital, Minneapolis, former employee of the Fort Snelling National Cemetery, former commander of Disabled American Veterans, Chapter 2, St. Paul. I have several hundred hours of volunteer service at the Hastings Veterans Home. It's my belief that you did not get the full story on the release of the director of the Hastings Veterans Home. First of all, as these gentlemen stated, there was no veterans complaining.
Mr. McAdon, could you just give us the question that you'd like to ask?
Mr. Franken was called in by the Nurses Union. Nurses Union and MAPE, another union, to the Hastings Veterans Home. The 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution says the federal government shall not infringe upon the state's rights to govern. That is a state veterans home. I ask Mr. Esvito why he pandered to the desires of Mr. Franken, why he did not tell him to go about his way, and we will investigate this ourselves. Mr. Franken did this, and as we read in the papers, the staff retaliation. Staff is a big word. Staff can refer to many things. Staff can, in this case, refers to the nurses' union.
So, Mr. Detmacher, what's your question?
I asked Mr. Acevedo why he did not send Mr. Franken on his way and investigate this himself, why he did not tell this panel that the investigator, the federal investigator, happened to be the director of the Minneapolis Veterans Home, who 4 days after the last snowstorm in December couldn't even get his own house in order and plow the parking lot at the VA hospital. Why, Mr. Acevedo, did you dismiss this individual? He has 1 year short of retirement. He is by far the most exemplary Mr. Chip Cox, director of any veterans home ever in the state of Minnesota. Why did you fire him?
Is that the question that you're asking?
It's unjustified.
Would someone from the department like to answer that quickly? I'd like to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Acevedo.
It is not the department's policy to discuss personnel issues. However, I will say that Mr. Cox left voluntarily from his position at the Veterans Home.
Thank you. Members, we are short of time, real short of time, so appreciate your attentiveness and your attendance. And no, the minutes were moved. And with that, I adjourn the meeting.